journey is long. Come walk with us, the journey is long.
Come walk with us, the journey is long. Come walk with us, the journey is long.
The journey, the journey, the journey is long. The journey, the journey, the journey is long.
The journey, the journey, the journey is long. The journey, the journey, the journey. Come walk with us,
come walk with us, the journey is long. Come walk with us, the journey is long. Come walk with us, the journey is long. Come walk with us, the journey is long.
The journey is long.
The journey, the journey, the journey is long. The journey, the journey, the journey is long. The journey, the journey, the journey is long.
The journey, the journey, the journey.
Listen to us,
listen to us,
our sorrow is great.
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 Our sorrow, our sorrow, 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 our sorrow is great.
Come talk with us,
come talk with us,
give meaning in life.
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 Give meaning,
give meaning,
give meaning in
life.
Give meaning,
give meaning,
give meaning in life.
Give meaning,
give meaning,
give meaning in life.
Give meaning,
give meaning,
give meaning.
Come walk with us,
come walk with us,
the journey is long.
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 The journey,
the journey,
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 the journey is long.
Beverly Wildung Harrison and I go back a long ways together because we both attended McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, way back when. I was way back winner than she was, but we overlapped. Now, when I asked her this morning, did you ever know then, when we were young women at McAllister College, where you were headed? And she said to me, my vocation was in my mother's dreams. Now let me tell you a little bit about that. She, by the way, is from Laverne, Minnesota, down in the southwest corner of Minnesota, almost into South Dakota. And her mother was a widow raising five children, by the way. Her brother is here, the youngest child, someplace.
Right out here.
Okay. She said after graduating from McAllister, where Robert McAfee Brown, Bob Brown, was teaching at that time, and then going to Union, she decided to go to Union to because I don't know why, because he was such a great teacher, education. But I know why she went there was to get an MRE degree, a degree in education, and probably come back to the Midwest to be a CE director. And later on, when she was ordained in the San Francisco Presbytery, it was explained to the fathers and brethren that ordaining a few women perhaps would not damage the church. And she had a 2.5-hour exam. Now, any of you who are Presbyterians know something about that. And that's it. That is an excessive exam. To get back to her mother, her grandfather, her mother's father, was thought that education was wasted on women. But her mother and her mother, her grandmother, conspired together to convince him to send her mother to Mankato for a 2-year music degree because she would become a better woman and a better church organist. And she also became a teacher. And that was a very large step. And she was passionate about education. And she became a Presbyterian after being in the Wisconsin Synod Church, where she was taken more seriously, I speak to you all you Presbyterians out there, as a woman, and came into contact with more liberal theology. I present to you Beverly Wildung Harrison. You don't want to hear from me the rest of the day. Who says, my vocation was in my mother's dreams.
I was very distressed this morning when it looked like Regalia had been misinformed about the time that she would speak, and I might have to go first, because I so much rejoice. One of my great loves coming back to Minnesota for the reimagining events is the way in which you construct these events. And I thought, I was greatly relieved to ask to be on the troubling the waters side of the discussion here, because, as you know, I am an ethicist by trade, a theological ethicist to be sure, but nevertheless not one of those great poets of feminist and womanist and Muharista theology, but one of the analysts. And so I was a bit concerned having to follow those brilliant, beautiful papers, rich with metaphor, poetry, that we had presented to us last night, as Mary and Rita summarized and interpreted what reimagining means and what is the practice, the commitment, the action that we presuppose. It was a relief not to have to carry the theological tradition, but I was also deeply moved at the prospect of being on the platform with my sister from South Africa, who has given such brilliant leadership amongst Christian women there. And to know that indeed it is the case at the end of this millennia of so-called Christian cultures, at the end of this millennia, that there really is a formal political and constitution in the world which is far better than the one our founding fathers wrote several hundred years ago. On paper now, progressive people around the world will have to measure the quality of their political and economic life, its real spiritual meaning, by the standards of the South African Constitution, even though it is not and is not likely soon to be more embodied than our own. And so it was with great joy that I situated what I had to say this morning in the context of what our sisters in South Africa have to say to us. For we live in a world where the voice of North Americans and most surely the voice of white, muddled middle strata, women in North America, not to mention the men, must be situated in a global a context of global truth. And so I looked forward to speaking of troubling the waters in this context this morning. Now, not being great with metaphors and not being a poet, I have trouble with titles, and I tend to use Latinate language that social analysts overlearn in school. And so I tried to think of a title for my remarks. And I started with, these are rather Latinate, Troubling the Waters When the Boys in Charge Don't Want Our Troubles Truthfully Named. I liked Rita's suggestion of courage and truth-telling as central to our practice. I also thought of Troubling the Waters in La La Land, Speaking Truthfully in Tinseltown, Jurassic Park, or Euro Disney, and a phrase that I used 4.5 years ago at this event, Troubling the Waters When Virtual Reality Gospel Has Become Big Business, capital B, capital B, or Speaking Truth to Power When We Brought Up All the Airways. But actually, I settled on something like swimming in troubled waters when the sharks are out in force. It is very tempting. In fact, it was very tempting over the last weeks, as I've thought about this morning, to go back and give you the same talk that I gave on an afternoon panel 4.5, nearly soon to be 5 years ago, not in this city, but in its twin. Because, truth to tell, revisiting the first great reimagining group that my friends and sisters in Minnesota and Geneva put together, oh, what a combination that was. Revisiting that, I think, is part of the important business that we should tend to. But I've had to suppress the desire simply to repeat what I said for several reasons. One, I always prepare a text, and I never pay much attention to it. So there are a lot of things I said that I simply don't remember. And the tapes were bad. And I got credited with saying some things that people in the audience actually said. In fact, the Presbyterian layman and the Institute for Religion and Democracy, so-called, and other such groups that employed full-time people to discredit what went on here, those folks got it wrong in many cases, but they didn't quote me very much, and I realized that I was tempted to repeat my speech because nobody really heard what I said. They didn't quote me because I used the occasion to explain to the particular group that had come to hear the ethics panel, to explain to folks why it is that so-called family values, and yes, in their nomenclature, hate is a family value, their family values account and their hatred of women who have abortions and who exercise reproductive choice, and their longing to kill the queers, and their longing to make feminism a dirty word. Look at that. Rita's right last night, folks. They really haven't succeeded in that. They've had to adopt some of our language. But why that was going to be on the hit list of the Christian right, and why it would appear to work for a long time to come. And I did explain it, and I did a pretty good job. And you know, the strangest thing happened. It turned out, Rita was quite right and profound last night in saying, we didn't take ourselves seriously enough. Now, all my life, I have been working on, use the academic language, a social anthropology, an understanding of human nature, which recognizes that we become individualized out of cultures and communities, and not the other way around, that the bourgeois man is the real evil myth of the capitalist Christian order. I've worked in that all my life, and there was a tremendous awakening in my eyes as I watched the Reimagining Conference. And I said, as many of you did, hey, we've got it right. Now, we didn't have enough money to videotape. If they had not had just those feeble, bad system tapes, but it had videotape, if they had had to look at this terrible art showing women's bodies and vaginas and all the things they used to scare and set off fear, if what we did ritually and spiritually could have been seen, they wouldn't have been able to get to us. Because, and I remind you, because what those of you who worked so hard 4.5 years ago and still working hard doing it again, as best I can see, managed to do was to link various sectors of the work of Christian women reimagining, revisioning tradition, and bring together two things that hadn't been brought together before in a conference, public event. Feminist ritual and feminist theological reimagining. And it was because we did what we talked about, or at least ritualized it as possibility, that many of us got excited, in spite of all the pain, in spite of all the things we flubbed, all the failure to make the power of racism, as we sit here in this largely white gathering, concrete and visible enough to see and make clear the real suffering that killing the queer, the passion for killing the queers, evisits on the moral and spiritual fiber of our communities. In spite of all those failures, and they were failures, in spite of that, we knew what we were doing. And so I wanted to give that speech. And then I said to myself, well, you really ought to show that you've learned something. And for actually, I haven't learned a whole lot. It's very depressing when I went back over those notes to see how really tempted I thought I had done my work. But I must tell you that one of the things that the first Reimagining Conference did for me was to, I think, it was the final step in my lifelong spiritual struggle. I talked about being a good Christian girl and being raised to be nice on that first conference, and I never can say how hard it is to get over being raised to be nice. Telling the truth takes much more courage. But in any case, in that context, I realized that what reimagining delivered me to was a recognition, a final recognition of a now 66, nearly 66 years. I mean, I'm over the hill, gang. And it finally delivered me into the power that is mine. I had followed my mother's dream, but without being connected, not to my own power. Believe me, I'm not a Dalyite. I don't believe that all power comes from within. It comes between. The theologians here will all tell you it comes between. But it really made me take myself much more seriously. And what have I done for the last 4.5 years? I've got news for you. I've been studying the Christian right. That's about all that I have been doing. And I want to begin today in talking about troubling the waters. Nearly through, and I'm just getting started. That seems to be my... By the way, I got this sloppy habit of talking this way in public when I was a junior and senior in high school down in La Vernon, and had my annual brush-up with Jean Audrey Powers from Mankato High School, and she and I fought for the championship of extemporaneous speaking in the high school... high schools of southwestern Minnesota, and... And one of the bad habits is that if you're an extemporaneous speaker, you get up on the platform and all of a sudden you realize you forgot in the hour they gave you to prepare the most important thing. And so you're always doubling back and not being very clear. But what really became clear to me in all of this is not that the right takes us seriously, and rightly so, and rightly so, but also that with their resources, they have won a great deal in this society. And so I want to speak for a little while soberly about the conditions in which we live and speak for troubling the waters. Now, I learned from a great theologian, not as great as he's sometimes credited, but a great theologian nevertheless, H. Richard Niebuhr, that when you are afraid of something, you should be very careful spiritually. In his class notes, I mean, people say, "Where you always talk about what H. Richard Niebuhr," I wrote my dissertation on him, said, and where did he say these things? I've read his books. I'd say in his class notes, because I wasn't one of his students, and they wouldn't let me see his papers because I was that young woman from Union Seminary in New York who hadn't even studied with him, and you're not permitted to worship at the shrine of academia if you haven't been on the inner circle, as you know. And so I had to dig it out of class notes, and I collected about 15 sets of class notes from his former students, and I read them. It was not the most helpful source for a dissertation because you can't cite class notes, but it taught me a great deal about what he was really up to theologically. And one of the things he said, if you are afraid, you watch your enemy. And what you watch, you imitate. And so I have had to learn, helped by the 12-step program to which I belong, not to let my enemies onto my eyeballs overmuch. Alice Walker was, of course, the one who said in the great Color Purple that we have to get the man off our eyeball if we're going to see anything at all. We have to get our enemies off our eyeballs too, but, and we need to understand, is that our enemies have out-resourced us and out-practiced us in the meanwhile. Now, it wasn't just a spontaneous outpouring of anything or a movement to the right in this society. Who knows where this society has moved politically? The next election, they're predicting that only 20% will vote of people who would be eligible. I think that's probably a little low, but basically nobody believes in politics anymore. That's their triumph. That's their triumph. What they have done is to convince people that the danger is within. They have developed victim blaming to a high art, killing the queers, making women use their wombs for the proper use of state production, whether it be enforced sterilization or the prevention of abortions by white women. And believe me, we're the ones they want not to have abortions. This agenda of them, and by the way, them is not a whole lot of smart people who are running the world. Them is greatly anonymous. We live in a world where evil is so objectified that we don't even know who's doing it. And it shouldn't be personified because, as I will say in a minute when I talk about reconceiving how we trouble the waters, the problems that we are in is that we have been given a script, and this makes me very angry, so I might quiver and even cry. In the name of Jesus Christ, we have been given a script which teaches us that if we just get rid of those whose lives are already greatly under siege, the gift of a perfect society will be upon us, driven by the free market God, who will establish a politically, a depoliticized society, we won't need politics because the market will take us where we need to go. Now, that is the script. That is the theology being established in this land and baptized in many of our denominations. And get me started about the heartbreak of being a Presbyterian, the embarrassment of it. I mean, one of the reasons I love coming here is I look out and I see Presbyterians I love, and I can remember why that church, which has taken such great joy in calling me a queer, lesbian, feminist, socialist, theologian, this is quoting the Presbyterian layman. Hey, girls, let's hear it, girls. Why? I've lost my point completely. This is trouble with getting connected with your passion. It's been my whole life getting connected with my passion, and now it's taken me over. This scenario has nothing to do with what is troubling us. It is a tissue of lies, and people are imbibing it. And I call it Jurassic Park theology. I call it virtual reality theology. You know, the Bible says clomp, clomp. Do you know that those ancient scriptures that took, multicultural scriptures that took 800 to 1,000 years to take shape and get passed on, and then another 1,000 years of the Christian era to get thoroughly deformed, is called the Bible, thump, thump. And 15 seconds later, they won't even be talking about it. They'll be telling you about family values and how it used to be when good faith prevailed in grandpa's home. And they will be giving you an account of Christianity that never existed under the sun, and urging you to put your time, your energy in keeping alive this faithful church, this remnant of God's, capitalist God's true people. Put your energies there. And in the meanwhile, they are stealing our lives. And I come to you today, I've left out so many points already, and time is rushing by. But I come to you today to remind you that people are dying of what the great lesbian, feminist, Jewish poet Adrienne Rich calls the lies, secrets, and silences that do not get uttered. And telling, truth-telling, and recognizing the extent of the threat to our little planet Earth is our business. The right has not won. Three times in the last week, the New York Times has reported in various versions and with a certain caution, typical of the times, that the Christian right is losing ground and that they're very frustrated. They are very frustrated, and they're doomed to be, because they do not see the contradiction in which their own efforts at truth-telling are set. But the facts are that time is running out. I'm not a pessimist and I'm not an optimist. I think pessimism and optimism are irrelevant to faith. But I am a believer in seeing the world as it is. It's the one remnant of Christian realism that I learned at the other Niebuhr's feet that I never lost. Make it complicated and make sure we see it in a complicated way. But we must start as we go into the next millennium. And I'm not going to be a seminary professor anymore. I'm going to be living out in the country and developing a new community of justice-loving friends. This is the church, of course, wherever it exists. And having getting a new venue on which to do my work. And I'm looking forward to it. But I have to tell you that I look forward to this next millennium, but I also think we have to be very sober about how much has been lost in the Bush-Reagan era. We mostly, because we come in a society which is liberal, I won't describe the limits of liberalism. I do not denounce, I have no, if somebody calls me a liberal in theology, I take it as a compliment because I realize that they're trying to warn people against me in the present climate. But the limits of liberalism are very severe, and one of the great limits of liberalism is that we do have a kind of what I'd call whitewashed view of history. And I use white the way Rita used it last night, as that drab, colorless, over neon world where the light, well, you can't see anything because the glare is so bright, and you especially can't see the beautiful colors, all the color. White is not a color, it's the absence of color. And in such a world as that, in such a liberal world as that, our temptation, and I speak now for whoever I speak for, but it, women who come from my roots are often here, and so I notice are some other women. In such a world as that, we often say, we are often drawn to spirituality for reasons not of embodiment, but of disembodiment. And this huge cry coming from in our culture for spirituality, for religion, which is everywhere, does very often not come from our strength, but from our weakness, from our longing from for deliverance from complexity. And the religious right has convinced people that spirituality is good, especially in its traditionalist form. We all long for tradition. I mean, the capitalism destroys tradition. It's the enemy. It eats everything in culture which will not accommodate to the bottom line. And so the beauty and particularities of our cultures are being sucked up and turned into commodities and bought and sold. But don't imagine that it's being deeply embodied and remembered and lived. We know this. And so we live in a society where much has been already undone, and we'd better be clear about this. I can only say a few things about this undoneness. What has been undone is, even in the tribes of Europe, even if you only look at this from the 4% or whatever of those of us who are whitened because we come from the cultures of Europe, even looked at from that standpoint, what has been undone is that most of the good struggle in our history has been eliminated. All efforts of working people over 150 years have been dismantled and set aside. The unions have been, they've been bought up or they have been thrown out. In fact, we have now, of course, reached the point where we don't need workers. So we have lost the struggles that animated our communities. I come back here to the Midwest, where populism runs so deep. Randy Nelson and I were talking a little bit about this yesterday, where the traditions of community building, of fair play, of participation in community, and of inclusiveness run so deep, and I see how quickly these traditions can be pushed aside. They have literally undone the best in the history of the peoples of Europe, not to mention what is wonderful and great in the cultures and communities of resistance among Native people, who we've nearly made extinct, among Afro-American people, on whom we have inflicted a violence unspeakable, a continuous re-perpetuation. And we live in a society in which we have a public ethos which suggests that this is the greatest nation and the finest civilization ever built. And it's full of apathy. And we are told that we don't need politics. If I had time to trace the successful ideological reconstruction of the right, I would spend a good deal of time explaining to you how they established something called political correctness, which they could make fun of, and make anyone who has a passionate concern for democracy labeled politically correct, excessive in their demands for equality and justice. This process of ideological reconstruction is very far advanced in this society. And the neoliberal theology, I'd like to talk about the theological constructions of the right, starting with the Chalcedonian, the Reconstructionist, the Christian Reconstructionism, taught at the Regents University down in Virginia, where the law professors have where the constitutional law professor in his constitutional law class has to get them to discuss whether it would be good, whether it would really work to making the Old Testament our Constitution, to make stoning queers a legal act, and where some 200 lawyers per year pass the Virginia bar out of that university. From that particular genre, it's an old Calvinist. We were talking about the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa, my dear. Here we have the old Calvinism as the right wing. I mean by this white capitalist god Calvinism, not the Calvinism I love and taught at one time. I'm still a bit of a Calvinist, but they forced a lot of it out of me because I've had to rethink the truth, the problematics of speaking the way I was taught to speak. But this theological tradition of right-wingism is really not the major form of their theology. The major form of their theology is what I call neoliberal. It's a much subtler form in which they maintain a certain split between politics and spirituality. And they insist, you see, that the beauty of the Christian worldview is that it maintains this split up to a point, but this new theology legitimates free market ideology. God really is a capitalist. It has many forms. They're not usually this crass, but they have many new versions of this. And out of this new theological mix, we are told, dream not. Politics, particularly left politics, the old movements and struggles for change, the civil rights movement, the 60s, all of these are excesses. They are politically correct, people who are trying to oversimplify our problems and make us go faster and further than it is wise to do. And they have made a lot of headway. Now, briefly, in the time remaining, I want to do two things. I want to talk a little bit about what actually has happened politically and economically that resituates the waters that we have to trouble. And then, and of course, this is very oversimplified. And then in a minute, I want to talk a little bit about recovering our imagery of an embodied moral life, which is at the heart of feminist, womanist, and mujerista theologies. What has happened is that since the end of the Second World War, very quietly and with hardly anyone noticing, a whole set of little events have taken place, starting with the Bretton Woods conferences in 1948, which established some institutions, intergovernmental institutions, to control emerging world economic system. Most especially at that point, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, now joined by coalitions, GATT coalitions, trade agreement coalitions, largely regional, in which governments agreed first to work together to promote economic stability and harmony. That was the beginning. And then, some 25 years later, there was a push and a shove to deregulate the currencies of the various nations, to establish conditions for the trade of money, creating an institutional opportunity where profit and wealth could be created that was completely detached from the actual material conditions of providing goods and services for communities and people, what we call the international finance markets. Now, the ideologists of neoliberalism would have you believe that the market, they always use capital T, capital M, the market is the most objective economic power in the world. Markets are simply institutions of exchange. And as Karl Marx said, markets have nothing to do with capitalism. They existed before capitalism, and they will continue after capitalism. What they're talking about is a particular form of advanced transnational market in which global wealth controlled through the corporations can control and eliminate all other countervailing economic force. And they have created an ideological system where the value of politics as community building is thoroughly discredited. And so, friends, when we trouble the waters, they have created formidable weapons, largely bought by a lot of highly educated people, as a scenario for problem solving, which will not help us. This is why we have, those of us who, yes, voted for Clinton, some of us even wore the buttons. This is why those of us who voted for Clinton have had to stand by and watch as he saved the transnational capitalist system. That's why he went to Africa, actually, of course. It was wonderful for the President of the United States to visit, but he wants those governments, including particularly Mandela's government, to release that land and sell it to transnationals. And so we need to be very honest and very sober about how tough this struggle is and how much we need to know. The work of feminist embodied ethics is material work. And that includes economic education and the struggle to recover respect for politics. And we had better see that and see it clearly, because these folks don't want the people to go into the streets and rise again. Having said that, let me finish very briefly by a reminder of that the embodied ethics, the practice of the life of justice seeking and love making that we struggle towards, we don't get there in our lifetime, but struggle towards, this practice of embodied ethics has to have three simultaneous levels. This is to say, in another way, what others have said, and it will be said by others again, but good ideas can be repeated several times. It doesn't hurt. Embodied ethics has to include, and we have to be careful, because those of us who come from the bourgeois worldview, the worldview of the muddled middle, tend to start, when we say bodies, we think of this. You know, and of course, the victimization we have known usually has to do with what's been done to this. So when we speak of embodiment, we tend to go too exclusively, not too quickly, but too exclusively, simply to the physical body, which is a beautiful, wonderful thing. But we must remember that body is our central metaphor at several levels. Body is, and here let us name him, I'm getting sentimental in my last year of seminary teaching, let us name my colleague Larry Rasmussen, whose great book, Earth Ethics, I hope you're all reading. He is quite right when he reminds us that the ozone layer is the skin we all have in common. And that everything that gets poured into the ozone layer is part of the environment of everybody. Mother Earth is our skin, and we are dumping our own waste. As Anne Primaverse said, we're dumping our own shit in our living room. But I mean, this is cosmic, it is planetary, and the people who run the transnationals couldn't care less. I'm not saying that the socialists, the former socialists, I don't think they ever really were, but they tried. Did any better. Everybody knows they didn't. These myopic men, any political group that doesn't have to be accountable to a lot of folks is myopic and dangerous. And that's the political revolution we have to continue to struggle for. But when we speak of embodied ethic, we speak in the awareness that our interconnectedness is not simply a Western epistemological monopolistic destruction, is the distinctiveness of cultures that are different from our own. Cultures and traditions, particularly of peoples who didn't buy in on this world of Western progress. And so we live in a society where the survival of cultures and traditions is the priority of a multicultural ethic. A multicultural embodied ethic of feminism. And then we return to our bodies, ourselves. This wonderful launching point for so many white feminists. Still, it really is a great launching point, and I don't apologize for it. But we need always to see our bodies and the issue of violence against the body through the prism of all of this. Racism is a structure of violence unbelievable. Classism, the power of wealth, is a structure of violence unbelievable. And the real problem with the muddled middle in the US is that we are being downsized and we haven't even noticed. And we have a bourgeois ethic of charity towards the poor, as though we and the poor weren't all in the same boat and part of the little planet Earth. And we teach people to feel sorry for the poor rather than recognize our solidarity with them, because we're all being impoverished faster than we know. We have it so wrong. And so we got a lot of troubling to do. And don't be surprised at any name they call you. Whether it's true or not is beside the point. They don't care. And all you have to go on is the truth-telling capacity of your friends. Let us speak truth to power, and let us do it in public, and let us take our stoles and our placards and go into the streets, and let us practice not a politics of charity, but a politics of solidarity with everyone whose voice is being removed from the truth-tellers and the testifiers. Let's keep it up, and let's make them fight us more if need be, because we have each other, and we know that the power of God is between us in what it is that sustains us. When those, and here I'll end where I began 4.5 years ago, when those who have become justice-loving friends, who we would never dare to hope to have as friends, when those folks tell us they need us and say thank you, and we can acknowledge to them how much they have given us, then we know the power of the Spirit, and she is with us. You had better believe it.
Thank you from our hands. and our hearts, every part of us. We have time now at table to share what's troubling, what we've heard that's moving us and stirring us. We want to suggest that you take time to pass the water around and stir it up with the things that you've heard, the things that are emerging from you and moving you to action from here. Take a few minutes to begin to share that stirring at your table.
Sorry to cut you off there if you're in the middle of something astounding, wonderful, deep. We would like to sing together, though, before we leave this room, which is what we're going to be doing shortly. And what we'd like you to do is look for this yellow sheet that came out today, our newsletter for the day. And let me just tell you that you're going to want to save this. This has on it the wonderful song, The Well is Deep. And it, let me just tell you briefly about this song. This song is in English, in Japanese, in Hawaiian, and in your books, the Spanish version is there. So there are four language versions of this song, but these three versions don't appear anywhere else but on this yellow sheet. So if you want to put this in your folders or your bags afterwards, first we're going to sing it though. Our well for the day, our well song. The English sounds like this. The well is deep, the water living, the well is deep, the memorizing these just as fast as you learn them, and you're doing such a wonderful job of that. Then we'll shift down to the bottom of the page and sing for this time the Hawaiian, and you want to listen to this once. We'll do it just a hair slower to get all the syllables in. It sounds like this. He kalua vai po'ale, he kawai mapuna e mana. Hekalua vai po'ale. Hekalua mapuna e mana. Together. Hekalua. Beautiful. Now we'll split up the room, and you and I can switch, Steve. Let's have this half of the room over here with Gloria and Steve. We'll sing the English for now, and this half is going to do Hawaiian with Tom and me. And then we're going to do that about three times. And then we're going to switch. So this side over here will be doing Hawaiian, and this side over here will be doing English. So just these two versions for now. In simultaneously. Am I out in the room now? Hello. Well, nice singing, Steve. Hello, anybody in the house? We're going to all start together. Over here, you're singing the... Here we go.
The well is deep.
You got it.
Ichabod.
Have a couple of announcements, and then we're going to be exiting the room because the kitchen staff needs to set up for our lunch, and they really need us to be out of here with everything as much as you can kind of cleared off your table. Perhaps you could put some things in your chairs or whatever. We'll be singing again, though, and there are more announcements from our...
Thank you. I was so moved by the leaders. Song that I forgot. An invitation, we're going to have some break time now, and we want to welcome you to check out the vendors, the bookstore, all those good places. We may not come back here until 12 o'clock because we want to allow the wait staff time to reset the room. To help them do that, as Mary said, what we need to do is be sure that everything from the tables except the bowl of water and the cloth and the numbers, whatever they are on your chairs, and the chairs are pushed into the table so that the wait staff has maximum freedom to move and the tables are completely clear for them. Also, an announcement about later this afternoon. The breakout rooms for our sessions this afternoon are identified in our booklets. They are all back this way, and we want to encourage you to use the corridor to the the back of the ballroom, the corridor across here, will take us to some of those rooms. The Governor's 2 breakout room, the room by that name, is the most challenging to find. But it is back this way, and if you use the main corridors, back here especially, you should be able to find your way to those rooms. They are all well marked. So we encourage you, we know that you're up to the challenge.
We go singing, faithful, flowing, troubling the water, standing by our sisters, we go singing now.
Please stand as you're able and turn with us to page 12 in our songbooks. We'll sing this wonderful reworking of Bringing in the Sheaves by our own Nancy Bernicke.